Yeah, you're like super in Canada. Yeah, you're right.
Every like 1 week, it just revert completely back.
You just develop a Midwestern Canadian accent.
Oh, I know, eh? So sorry about that.
That was truly surreal hearing that voice come out of you. Letterkenny, Justin. That's where we're at now.
That's right. Yeah. Does anyone outside of Canada even get that show?
Letterkenny? I love Letterkenny.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll admit, though, I didn't watch after like the first couple seasons or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I think up to like season four, I was kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
You're like, you're doing the same things over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Too much. And then eventually it was like the classic show gets canceled, comes back, everyone's really excited, and it's terrible. Yeah. Other Canadian show that happened to is Trailer Park Boys.
That one left and came back like 7 times.
Look forward, everyone, to the Trip Sitter podcast getting canceled and then coming back worse than ever.
Yeah, I can't wait to get canceled and come back worse.
Yeah, you better enjoy it now because this is peak podcasting for Trip Sitter. It's all downhill from here.
You're listening to the Trip Sitter podcast, where we demystify substances, break down the science behind them, and discuss the crazy world of psychedelic culture. Like having a Trip Sitter watch over your experience, our goal is to provide guidance and support in preparation for your psychedelic journey. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the trip. Well, I thought it would be a good idea for us to do an episode where we kind of just talk about our own personal drug journeys. We're probably going to be releasing this episode right around the time of New Year's. So kind of thought we could center it around alcohol, since I assume that's where a lot of our journeys have kind of began or have at least been shaped by in some way. Just jump off there and see if we can, you know, make something that's worth listening to.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm really interested to hear the two of you because I've had a real wild journey with like substances and stuff. Mm. And so I'm real interested to see because we also are each from a very specific background, like the countries that we are from and the states that we are from. Mm. So I'm real excited to see how the, you know, middle class Long Island experience compares to the Tennessee, to the Canadian experience.
Yeah, well, and I actually also grew up in Flint, Michigan, so it was an even different experience. But yeah, the Deep South, you know, that's where I learned to like drugs. Mm. And it's definitely been kind of wild. Like, I was even kind of like entertaining the idea of, I have a friend who moved to Colorado who we were visiting with her the other day, and I was like, man, that'd be cool to live in Colorado. And then I was like, what would it be like to not worry at all about drugs?
That's pretty nice, I have to say.
Yeah, it's just been total paranoia the whole time I've liked drugs.
Yeah, I don't think it's like the weed that causes the paranoia. It's the laws and everything around it and the implications of it.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, let's go ahead and I'm going to grab a jacket real quick.
I realize when James comes back, we should probably do our introductions.
That's what I was going to say.
Oh my God, it's almost like you're a producer.
Yeah. Almost.
So let's go ahead and do our introductions.
Hi, I'm Rowan. I'm a contributor for Trip Sitter.
And I'm James. I'm also a contributor for Trip Sitter.
I'm Justin. I'm also a contributor for Trip Sitter.
And today we don't have a guest. It's just us. So like it or leave it.
I do like that you like kind of humbled yourself today, Justin. You're like, yeah, I'm just a contributor. I'm not the editor in chief and founder of Trip Sitter.
Yeah, I'm just like, I'm just a contributor. I'm like standing on my high horse, like I need to blend in. Not that special.
Well, someone on here needs some authority.
I'm the wrong guy for that, I think.
Oh man. Okay, so where do we start? I guess first of all, I also brought a beer that I'm going to drink while we're talking.
Ooh, what are you drinking? Quick plug.
This is a local IPA, or local to Michigan. It's a Founders Centennial IPA.
Ooh.
Let me get that in there.
Fancy.
For the cameras. I guess I'll probably just cut all this audio out.
No, you have to hold on. Wait, can we get a good crack on audio?
Yeah.
Ooh. Ooh, yeah. So crisp.
For the ASMR crew.
The first podcast I was ever on was a local podcast here called Trade Skills Podcast. Another plug. But just like put a call out on like this local Facebook group and were like, hey, we just talk to people who have interesting stories while we drink beer. Want to come on? And so I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? And so we just like talked about drugs for like 2 hours. And then every now and then they were like, all right, let's open another beer. And I was like, this is so dangerous.
You're like, I have no idea what's happening.
Yeah.
There is no harm reduction involved in this whatsoever.
Yeah. That makes me think of like Drunk History. Have you guys ever seen that? Yeah, you get these historians telling the story, but they're getting progressively drunker over the course of an hour or two telling the story.
Honestly, we should do that, but we should just get people like on an acid trip or a mushroom trip, just being like, all right, and here we go. Like 3 hours in, they're peaking.
Oh, yeah. Well, at that point, you can like tell the whole history of the universe. So it'd be a really interesting episode, I'm sure. Cosmic Lord Gorb once.
That's makes for good content.
Please be Lord Gorb.
Yeah, I mean, entire books have been written like that.
Oh, God. My like question pertaining to the episode is two questions. One, what's everyone's drink of choice? Like, when you're going out to a bar or something, what's your drink of choice? And two, when was your first drink and what was the context?
Oh, man, that's a fun story. I would say it depends on like what I'm looking to do for my drink of choice. If I'm like meeting a group of people that I don't know very well and I'm like kind of nervous or whatever, then I'm a whiskey Coke guy, because after one, you're like kind of loose already. And so I can go out and have like two whiskey Cokes and have a great time and I'm good. But if I'm like with people that I know really well and I don't have to like overcome that social anxiety, I don't need that social lubricant, then I like to stick to beer, usually IPA, but in the winter I like to switch over to like a porter or a stout, something dark. Yeah. Oh, and then my first drink, I was 13.
Tripsitter does not encourage underage drinking.
Yeah, and trust me, this is not a glamorous story, so I am not about to glamorize underage drinking.
I think it rarely is at 13.
Yeah, so I had a buddy whose mom was very open to buying him alcohol.
As long as you're in the house, it's okay.
And that's the thought, yeah. And so one day we got her to buy us a fifth of the cheapest vodka. It was called 5 o'clock vodka. Came in a plastic jug. And he had like these double shot glasses. So we just took like two double shots each of straight 5 o'clock vodka. And then we went to CC's Pizza and ate like just a shitload of pizza. And then came back and made like a mixed drink with Sunny D. And we went on a walk around his neighborhood. And I remember we made it like down two of the four streets to walk like a full block. And I don't remember the other two. And I woke up at around midnight to his mom like shaking me awake and being like, you gotta eat something. And she'd be like, made me eat a Hot Pocket.
Yes, hair of the dog, Hot Pocket.
And I just like remember like I was still kind of drunk and I like couldn't really understand what was going on, but I just knew something smelled like vomit. And at the time I had hair that was like down to like my nipple, like this long curly hair, classic rock style. And when I woke up the next morning, I found out that there was puke all in it that had just like dried in it overnight. And so I walked home disgusting, just in time to like hop in the shower before my dad came back from playing golf and managed to like not get caught. I couldn't drink vodka for probably 10 years. I very distinctly remember when I was like working in a liquor store, a vodka distributor was giving out free samples and I was like, all right, fine, I'll like give it a shot. And I was like, oh, this is okay now. I was like so excited.
I was worried that was gonna go bad. I was worried you'd be like, yeah, and at work I just threw up.
No.
That's the funny thing with alcohol. If you have one like just really bad night, it can ruin that drink for decades afterwards.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's like that with food or anything like that. Anything that makes you throw up, honestly, can just be ruined for you. I had a buddy who couldn't eat eggs because he accidentally ate some like expired eggs when he was in high school, and he just couldn't eat eggs for like another 15 years.
That feels like a real primal survival instinct.
Yeah, that seems like a good instinct to have.
Yeah, it's probably not even a bad one. You're like, wow, that food tried to kill me once. Like, maybe I just don't need to eat it again.
Plenty of other foods.
Yeah.
All right, I'll go next. I rarely drink, but when I do, I'll go for beer as well. I'm a big fan of the hazy pale ales. There's this brewery, quick plug, another plug, a local craft brewery out of Vancouver called Yellow Dog.
Oh, you mean doing things in moderation?
Moderation, yeah. Pretty breakthrough.
Yeah, I mean, like, all all drugs are great for moderation. Like, obviously, like, even like taking like good tolerance breaks from weed makes weed feel a lot better too. But like, weed is still enjoyable even if you have a tolerance to it and you're smoking on a daily basis. Alcohol is not enjoyable if you have a tolerance to it. But if you don't, you can like actually enjoy two beers and be done and like have a good time.
Yeah, you just nurse it after that. Just drink it slowly and maintain. Yeah.
So what was the first one? Was beer
my
the
first drink I ever had? Yeah. I used to go camping a lot with my family, and there was often like some of my friends would come. So one day after everyone went to sleep, snuck out of our tent and stole two beers from my parents' cooler and ran off into the forest to try it. I think we had like four sips and we were like, ugh, why do I can't drink this?
Like, this is garbage. This tastes terrible.
And that's it. And I put it down for probably 4 years till high school. And then obviously, like most other people, went a little bit off the rails for a couple of years. And before I learned to dial it back in moderation, now everything's good.
Yeah, I wanted to come back to that like eventually, like the Canadian versus American like binge drinking culture. I'm interested to hear how that is over there.
Yeah. Yeah.
My first drink I ever had, I was like 3 or 4 during like a Jewish preschool ritual. And the people who were running the preschool had like grape wine and then like grape juice because there was like an actual religious program happening. And so they were supposed to do a Seder, like a fake Seder, and they gave us real wine by accident. And I remember like one of my earliest memories of being in this preschool is one of these adults being like, oh fuck, oh fuck, oh fuck, just like realizing what they'd done. And then a couple years went by, I was at a 4th of July party and one of my like dad's friends had like fake beer, non-alcoholic beer. That was very judgmental of me.
Yeah. Poser ass beer.
Fucking fake beer.
Get drunk or go home.
E-beer.
I mean, let's be real. It was skunk beer. It was, I can't remember what the like brand of it was. Maybe like Beck's or something. Oh, yeah. Oh, but it was just garbage. I was like, it was very much the thing of like, yeah, you should drink this beer so that way you never drink anything ever again.
That's smart. Yeah.
Definitely well thought out. Then the first time I got like fucked up was like 8th grade, freshman year of high school. So like 12, 13 also, James.
Yep. Yep. That's but the year to do it. I mean, not that's it. Not the year to do it.
I really think our prime audience is 8 to 15 year olds, so I think that's really important.
Yeah, I guess we are marketed as 18 plus, and if you're 18 in Canada, you can legally do it. So
only in Alberta.
Only in Alberta now.
I don't know if there's other provinces, but BC is 19 sure.
Oh, 19.
What is it, 21 there where you guys are? That doesn't even make sense.
They were
sense.
Trying to make it older at some point. Yeah.
My mom, she told a lot of stories that I'm not sure if they were necessarily true, but she told me once that she was 17 when they moved the age from 18 to 21 and they did it incrementally. So like the next year it was 19 was like the max age and then 20. And for 4 years, she was 1 year away from being able to drink.
My mom tells the exact same story. So
really?
Yeah, 1964, I think. Is the year
that might be right. I'm a bad son. I don't know what year she was born, but that feels in my bones like the right answer.
So the first drink proper that I ever had, I can't remember, I was like watching something on YouTube or I was like on Facebook because I had just gotten a Facebook. So I was probably 13. That sounds about right. Mm. Because I obviously don't have a Facebook account if you're under 13. That I think is actually much more severe. But I had 15 shots of Bacardi and Malibu.
That's too many.
That's far too many. Yeah, far that's too many. Many.
Quick maths.
Because I was like, oh, I should like try this out. Why not?
And let's experiment like, as much as I can right now.
I took a heroic dose of Bacardi.
The Zeus Tapato method.
An inside joke for listeners, fans of the pod.
Yeah.
And that was, of course, a terrible mistake. And then I threw up exorcist style around my room and woke up the next morning just dead to the world, I'm pretty sure. And then I still have not drank Bacardi since because done forever.
Yeah, that one's locked in or locked out, I guess. How are you looking at it?
So I'd be a terrible pirate. No rum for me.
Yeah, I forgot to include the childhood alcohol because I did have a few occasions where my mom would let me have champagne, I think when I was like 7 or 8 on New Year's. And then I remember when she got remarried when I was 12, they didn't have any champagne. So they gave me a flask of whiskey and told me I could have a swig from the whiskey. And that was terrible. I was pretty sure I couldn't drink whiskey after that. And then I can't remember if it was before or after the time that I mentioned, but there was a time where I stole beer from, well, it was my whole family during New Year's Eve. We used to get pretty raunchy. I have a lot of alcoholism in my family. So anyways, there was...
I really do just love the like, yeah, and moving past. And we're
yeah,
gone.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Just drop these little bombs as he's going.
And so the natty lights were overflowing.
We live in abundance.
Yeah. I would like hide them in the bathroom in like the towels in the closet. And then I would like sneak away into the bathroom and chug a full beer. And then hide the can. And then like at the end of the night, I had to like go put all the cans in the recycling or whatever. But yeah, that was...
You just got to sneak it in. If you put it far enough under, they won't notice. Or if there are enough of them, you just blend it in.
Exactly. Yeah. Natty light is not a good first beer.
I've never even heard of that one. That just like super cheap, shitty beer? Yeah,
Natural Light. Like, it's a big college beer here.
We have like Tong and Hammer here, and like every can you pour out is a different color. The only way to drink those is by beer bong or something. Like yeah, you can't taste them. It's horrible.
Yeah, so I guess like the big transition for me, and I don't know if this is true for y'all, like the three of us aren't big drinkers. I think that's fair to say at least. I don't want to speak for everyone. Rare. But it seems like a lot of people who like try weed or other drugs realize that alcohol is just not a very good drug. Or like it is good in certain occasions, but not for the ones we really use it for. Like it's not great to really relax at the end of the day because it makes you sluggish the next day. It's not a great way to party with friends if you don't do it in moderation because you wind up the next day feeling like, oh my God, what did I do last night? And not only that, but you can't even really remember the interactions that you have, right? So it's like high conversations might be nonsensical or whatever, but the next day you can laugh about them.
And you feel bonded.
Yeah, you feel bonded in them.
I think it's funny too, like, I mean, this is more true with beer than any other alcohol, but the hops in beer, which is a key ingredient, is a sedative.
Yeah.
You know, it's not good for like libido. It's not good for staying out late. It just puts you to bed, but that's like the go-to for like partying and stuff. It's kind of funny.
Really not that great for date nights. Like weed or, I mean, obviously like MDMA, if you're both hip to it, would be great for a date night. But if you're both hip to it and consenting adults, but...
I mean, a little bit less than alcohol.
Don't do MDMA if you're 13 and listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
if you're 13, get off this podcast right now.
Yeah.
How about that?
Also, test your MDMA. That's your harm reduction note.
There you go.
But yeah, I don't know about all of us. I know Justin said that he also had a little bit of a chaotic drinking period or whatever.
Yeah.
I know that I definitely did as well. And I didn't start smoking weed until after me and my ex split up and I moved back to Nashville and I got my first job that didn't drug test. And my opinions on it had evolved from my poor thinking on drugs. And when I started smoking weed, I was immediately like, this is way better. At the time, I was brewing my own beer, which was like a cool hobby. And I still think it's like a really cool thing to do. And it's like mad cheap. You can spend like $20 on a batch of beer and make 50 bottles of it. And I had gone through like two batches of beer that I like really loved. And I had a third that was fermenting. And then like when I started smoking weed, it just like sat in my closet for like 12 months. I had to like throw it out. There's like mold growing on it.
Super fermented.
Like still in the like fermentation stage?
Yeah, because I just like totally left it in there like way too long. Like there's like a certain period of time that
probably
you
probably just
leave
have
it.
Like vinegar at the end of that.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if beer
goes
vinegary or not.
I just like completely lost interest in alcohol, like in general. I pretty quickly became like an almost daily smoker, and I realized that that had a way less degenerative effect on my life than when I was a daily drinker. Even if I was only drinking after work, you know, like I came to weed and other drugs pretty late in life. A lot of people wind up kind of like settling on weed after having it kind of mixed with alcohol and stuff throughout their college years. But did that kind of feel like y'all's experience too? Or do you feel like the others just kind of took over and like alcohol died down?
I have a pretty like thorough and intense answer for this. It doesn't, you know?
All right. Yeah. My answers are usually pretty quick. I feel like for me, it started out with weed. I would smoke weed like all the time in high school and we would drink on the weekends, but it was kind of like extra. It was mostly weed. Even you go to parties, like crack a couple of beers, but everyone's out back smoking. That was just kind of the thing to do. And it was after definitely like a few, maybe two or three years shortly after high school, it's kind of like starting to lose its interest for me. A, it's like really expensive. I was a student. I had no money. Mm-hmm. Constantly just using all my money going to the bars on like Friday night or something. Yeah. I feel like shit on Saturday. It makes me unproductive. And I just don't like the way it makes me feel, where you kind of lose control of your body, which I think is the draw for most people that drink. It's mm-hmm. that yeah. disinhibition and like you can just let loose, right? I don't mm-hmm. like that. I like to more like dial in. And for me, like weed.
You don't like being out of control?
Hard to believe, right?
Which is ironic, though, considering your psychedelic consumption. An interesting note.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, you could probably argue that you're more out of control on psychedelics. Well, until you get to pretty high doses of alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, I always stick to the tryptamines, too, though. And I feel like those, as far out as you get, you're still here. I can still think. My brain is still functioning. I know who I am for the most part, you know, for some periods. But then other drugs like the aryl cyclohexylamines, like PCP or ketamine, like those, you could argue are very psychedelic too. Those have never been a huge draw to me because those are more the disconnect from yourself than the like expand outward, which I don't know how to describe that, but I would consider that different.
Absolutely.
You know
what
I mean? They're both NMDAR antagonists, right? So like they've acted in similar ways too.
Alcohol and ketamine? Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I don't know about PCP, but I know that it's like the same receptor.
Same thing. Yeah. NMDA receptor. And I think just like ketamine and alcohol too, it's a dirty drug in that it doesn't just hit one thing. It targets like NMDA, GABA, adenosine, even opioids, acetylcholine. So so they're both hitting kind of the same buttons, but in like different ratios. So they have overlapping effects, but unique character.
Yeah, which is really fascinating.
Pretend like it's just still going on the podcast and just introduce the question or
I don't know. I think it's kind of funny that we got like so excited about what we were talking about that we never even broke down what alcohol is. So I think it's kind of cool to say like, hey, we're coming back a little bit after this recording because we missed some pretty major shit.
Yeah. All right.
The whole like point of what we do, we missed that because we were just chatting. So yeah, I was hoping you could break down a little bit about alcohol from a pharmacological standpoint and also a little bit about the toxicity of it so we can make sure to inform our listeners.
Yeah, alcohol is actually a really interesting one. It's a really simple molecule. Like if you look at the molecular structure of alcohol, it's tiny. Ethanol we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different types of alcohol, but we're talking about ethanol. But it can just touch all kinds of different receptors. Kind of like we recorded an episode on ketamine recently, which won't be out at the time of this recording, but it's like ketamine in that it's considered a dirty drug, air quotes, because it can't really decide what receptors to push, but the main ones that it is pushing are actually very similar to ketamine as well. The GABA A receptors, which are basically the main like neurotransmitter in your brain, is GABA.
Right.
I always think of it as the brake pedal of the brain. It's like you're racing down a hill, you know, when you're super anxious, everything's going crazy, your brain is firing on 1,000 cylinders. GABA kind of steps in to like slow everything down, pushes the brakes by slowing nerve impulses throughout the brain. With less nerve impulses, we become less active, less anxious. In high doses, it can make us feel really sedated, and it can also have an intoxicating effect. Probably the strongest class that does that is the benzodiazepines. Those are very, very selective for the GABA receptors. They're like the ultimate sort of chill pill.
Is GABA the chemical that builds up throughout the day and makes you sleepy, or am I thinking
of something
else?
Oh, okay. That's adenosine, yeah. So that's how coffee works. Coffee basically kicks all the adenosine off.
Right.
So the GABAergics are like alcohol, GHB, ketamine, barbiturates, benzodiazepines, phenibut, L-theanine a little bit, stuff like that, like the very like kind of calming, sedating. But then there's this really unique kind of twist on it that they can also be quite intoxicating. Like you get a lot of like memory loss, disinhibition, you know, like when you're drinking and you say or do things that you normally wouldn't, you don't have that like inhibition, I guess, that kind of is in your mind saying I shouldn't do this or say this. So there's some interesting stuff with that. The other thing that alcohol does, the main one, is the NMDA receptors, which is very similar to ketamine and the dissociatives. And if you think about like when you're really drunk, there is a very like dissociative sort of effect going on.
Right.
Like you're not in control of your body, depending on how drunk you are. It can be very sedating, you know, like when people get like blackout drunk, they're kind of anesthetized.
Right.
So those are the two main ones, but there's a bunch of other things that alcohol does. One of them is the serotonin receptors. That one's really complicated, and I've tried to get to the bottom of exactly what it's doing to serotonin, and there's so many different things. It just completely depends what part of the brain, different subtypes of serotonin. But one of the main ones is the 5-HT3 serotonin receptors, which is actually really intimately involved with like our nausea response. There's a region in the brain stem that controls nausea, and the 5-HT3 is really involved with that. So that largely explains its emetic effects. You know, when you drink too much alcohol and you start throwing out, you feel nauseous.
us. That's that serotonergic kind of action. It also has some role in dopamine that's equally as complicated and would require like a full hour or two just to try to break that apart.
Yeah, I think like any monoamine chemical, mm-hmm. it's like always super complicated because all of them are super complicated. Like
you can't just say like increases dopamine. It's like, yeah, exactly. That might be true. But then if you look somewhere else, it could be decreasing dopamine or it could just be modulating dopamine's action.
Depending on where it is in the brain or body, like increasing dopamine could have completely different effects.
Totally. Yeah. Our brain and body in general really likes to reuse these neurotransmitters. And instead of making a new molecule to send a specific type of message, it'll just reuse the same one in a different context, which is fascinating in its own right. I mean, you look at the stomach, one of the largest concentrations of serotonin in the body, but we think of serotonin as specifically to mood. It does way more than that.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving down the list, these are just really minor, so I'm just going to briefly touch on these. Alcohol also affects the cholinergic system, so acetylcholine, which is involved with like memory, learning, even muscle coordination, contraction. Mm-hmm. Glycine does affect adenosine, which is what we briefly talked about, making us feel sleepy, or if you kick them off, it makes us feel awake.
Does it increase that amount? That's like where some of the sedation comes from?
Yeah, I think it just changes the way that adenosine balance works in the brain.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah, that again, I feel like there's a lot of complex stuff going on, but it's like, you know, in the early stages of drinking, you feel kind of euphoric and awake, but then the later stages, you feel very tired and sedated. So there's some kind of a shift that happens.
Totally, yeah, that makes sense.
Low dose versus high dose. And then the other one is the potassium channels, which again, coming up in our ketamine discussion, we talk about the potassium channels. Just like the sodium channels, they're sort of the regulator of neurotransmission. They allow electrical signals to travel from one region of the brain to another. So by inhibiting it, basically making it harder for one signal to move to the other, and therefore less activity is going on, therefore we feel sedated. You know, it's hard for us to focus on things, hard to remember things. In very high doses, we become basically anesthetized from that. So those are kind of the main mechanisms of action with alcohol. Again, there are probably many others, so if I missed any, please comments.
Can you briefly touch on the toxicity of alcohol?
Yeah, so, okay, in order to really to focus on the toxic aspects of alcohol, we got to kind of cover a little bit of the metabolism, which is really interesting in its own right. So alcohol is pretty much exclusively metabolized by an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase, which is only found in the liver, as far as I know. Mm. It converts it to a compound called acetaldehyde, which itself is converted to acetyl coenzyme A, which is a very common compound in the body. We use it in the citric cycle to make energy. So we actually convert alcohol into energy, like usable energy.
Interesting.
I've heard a lot of people claim that alcohol is low calorie. I drink only vodka because it's low calorie. Mm-hmm. And I think the argument for that is interesting because alcohol is converted to actually quite a bit of energy, but it takes so much energy for that first step to turn into acetaldehyde that the argument is that it's like net neutral.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, but here's where a lot of the problems come. And it's the same kind of problems that come with like refined sugar. So we're having this very high energy creation, which requires some minerals, especially B1, vitamin B1 and like choline to produce this compound. And if we're not replacing that, we're just getting high energy output and nutritional depletion on another front. Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest problems with chronic alcohol consumption is a condition called fatty liver disease. Mm-hmm. That's a combination of both of those. It's the depletion of essential nutrients to properly process that energy and the excess energy, which the body stores as fat. So a lot of that fat just ends up accumulating in the liver.
Interesting. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of like nutrient deficiency type problems that come from that. Like I read this old medical book and one of their indicators of alcoholism was basically like beriberi, which is a nutritional deficiency, peripheral neuropathy, and this condition called Wernicke's syndrome. All of them we now know are a deficiency of vitamin B1. So people are coming into these hospitals or clinics with these nutrient deficiencies and they were using that as a sign for alcoholism.
That's super interesting.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of that before.
Yeah. I found some other interesting info here. The liver can process about 8 grams of pure ethanol every hour. And at maximum capacity, that produces around 2,000 calories every 24 hours. So there is quite a bit of energy that can be derived from alcohol.
Oh, cool. So you could probably just live off of it.
If you're taking the B vitamins and the choline and the amino acids.
And 8 grams of ethanol per hour or whatever. Yeah.
Which is a lot. It also messes with blood glucose regulation pretty heavily. And it can cause a lot of problems with like vasoconstriction, right? Mm-hmm. Which is our ability to contract our blood vessels. Mm-hmm. There's this weird thing that happens with alcohol. When you drink alcohol, it can't contract. So your blood vessels are very relaxed. So your heart rate has to increase in order to maintain the same kind of pressure. But then as the alcohol starts to wear off, you get kind of the opposite effect where it kind of becomes too contracted and you start to have headache and high blood pressure kind of problems.
Wow. That's super interesting. Yeah.
So a lot of actually what hangovers are like the nutrient sort of deficiency caused by the alcohol.
Magnesium, oh, that's interesting.
B vitamins.
Yeah. I'd always heard dehydration hydration.
And dehydration too.
But that makes sense that they would kind of work together for sure.
Yeah.
B1 is not like a super common vitamin either, right? Isn't it mostly 6 and 12 that kind of like get talked about?
They always get talked about. And that's because B1 is so abundant in a lot of things.
Okay.
You can get it from like meats, fish, nuts, what else? Eggs, legumes, seeds. And I don't know why B1 is being used so much. I think it has something to do with that alcohol dehydrogenase enzyme. Like a lot of these B vitamins, they act as kind of coenzymes. Like they don't do the function of metabolizing, but they're a necessary like tool for that enzyme to do its function. Magnesium acts like that too, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I thought we should talk about maybe, which would be probably a lot of our listeners would be interested in, is like hangover cure stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So taking all of that into account with, you know, depletion of B vitamins and magnesium, the easiest thing to do is make sure that you're getting those vitamins. Have a really good meal before you go out drinking. Even take some B vitamins.
Oh, that totally makes sense, because like my hangover meal was always like a big ass omelet, which eggs have a lot of the magnesium too, and the B1 vitamins.
So,
yeah. No, that's so interesting. And then like the other thing people will eat is like a greasy burger or, you know, those kinds of, that's so interesting. That makes sense.
It's funny. Our body has a really good intuition for that kind of stuff. You know, like why do we crave certain foods at certain times? Just trust your gut. There's a good reason for it. Those foods have a lot of the nutrients that we're missing or that are depleted when we're out drinking.
Yeah.
So yeah, some other good ones. There's this really interesting compound called dihydromyrcetin, DHM. You can buy supplements that have this stuff in it. It comes from, I think, a few different plants. The one I know it in, it's a Chinese plant called Hovenia dulcis. This plant like directly increases alcohol dehydrogenase.
So oh, interesting.
That, yeah, like while you're drinking or especially kind of near the end of the night, take some of that, drink lots of water, have some food. And then the idea is that it's going to metabolize the alcohol out of your body much more quickly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cool research with that. And there was even an old Chinese Materia Medica that called for that. I think it was called the Tang Materia Medica. It's like 1,000 years old or something like that. I'm not exactly sure what era it came in, but it was one of the first like Chinese Materia Medicas. There's a few others, like ginger is probably the best if you're feeling the nausea kind of effects. I don't think there's a better anti-nausea herb out there, to be honest. Big, strong tea, fresh ginger root. You can just slice it up, stick it in a pot of water and boil it for about 10 minutes. Works pretty magically. We've got, I mean, obviously hydration is the main one. There's a compound of milk thistle called silymarin, which is like a very specific liver medicine. It's been shown in lots of different studies. There's a lot of like pseudo-pharmaceutical kind of preparations of this one.
Yeah.
Prevents like fibrosis. So again, one of the big problems with drinking a lot, you get the fatty deposits and then you start to get like a fibrous tissue forming, like a hard tissue that interrupts the liver's ability to function normally. Silymarin has been shown to slow or completely block the fibrous production. It's also a very strong antioxidant. One of the downsides too of creating acetaldehyde is it creates a lot of free radical compounds that the body kind of has to figure out how to deal with. If it doesn't, it can start to damage the cells. So between the silymarin itself, other compounds in the milk thistle, and then a natural antioxidant system in the body, very strong in the liver, called glutathione, it kind of protects against that. And then there's some research that shows that it actually has some sort of liver cell regenerative abilities.
Wow, okay, that's cool.
Yeah, so that's a really good one to kind of have around. And then basically any bitter herb. This is getting a lot more into like herbal medicine side of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can find like herbal bitters with like dandelion or gentian or angelica, burdock, globe artichoke, stuff like that. And the idea is that when you taste bitter, there's a receptors on the back of your tongue and then in the section just below your stomach that detect bitter, and they send signals to your liver to tell it to power up, basically, because a lot of bitter foods have fatty compounds, which require bile from the liver and the gallbladder to break down.
Mm-hmm.
And also a lot of like medicinal alkaloids, poisonous compounds too, have a very bitter.
Could you get a similar effect just like chomping on a lemon or something?
Possibly, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's more sour than bitter.
Lemon does do that though, but bitter foods in general. But the thing with the herbal bitter is really nice because they usually come in like drops and it, you can both taste it, and the taste is very important to get that reaction. But then the kind of concentrated bitter compounds still go down and does more of that further down in your digestive tract as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
The idea is like by telling the liver, like, get ready, like, you know, you're going to have some work coming. It can be a little bit more prepared.
Right, yeah.
And that's, again, more of a traditional medicine sort of concept. And then the other main one I had here, there's so many different hangover cures. These are just my favorites. St. John's wort is like premier like antidepressant herb. And like, not saying that people that going drinking should be taking like antidepressants as a way to fix it, but these kind of more gentle herbal ones are a really good alternative to that.
Yeah.
They're safer. They're not, they don't have as much problems. It's a little bit harder to overdo them, but
You're not saying like taking an SSRI for the first time or whatever, but
yeah, not a pharmaceutical SSRI, but St. John's Wort actually works through basically the same mechanism as SSRIs, which is interesting.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't
it's
know
good
that.
For the kind of like, you know, Monday morning blues kind of, you know, where you're just feeling down at a hectic weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think honestly having food and then like every second or third drink, just having water probably goes the furthest than any of these other like supplements we're talking about here.
Yeah. I wanted to close out asking you what your opinion was on kava versus alcohol. Do you think that they are like similar enough to compare like that? I know that that's like a common comparison. Or do you think that kava is kind of like its own thing, even though it does have some kind of similar feels?
Yeah, I think they are pretty similar. The thing with kava, like you'll never get as drunk with kava as you can with alcohol, but you can get to that kind of nice, almost like tipsy sort of level where you're a little euphoric, you feel a lot more chatty, you feel relaxed. If that's what you're going for with alcohol, which is what I personally like with alcohol, I like to get to that level and just kind of coast there. With kava, it's really easy to get there and just maintain that for like several hours. It lasts a lot longer than alcohol in that sense.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And
that's cool.
There are some concerns with like, especially heavy consumption of kava on the liver as well. Mm-hmm. But that's through totally different mechanisms. And there's a lot of kind of debunking research on that with even like recreational doses of it. You need to basically be drinking heavy doses of kava for a long time. You might start to have some liver damage from that, but not like
that's
alcohol.
Interesting. Yeah. Cool. I think that's everything we needed for the insert. So we're going to go back to the chat now.
Awesome.
Because like ketamine is making people think about antidepressant treatment in entirely new ways, because they never thought of that NMDA receptor being a potential target for antidepressant pharmaceuticals at all.
Yeah, because all the other ones we've had put people in, you know, states of psychosis. They cause, I can't remember what they're called, but like basically they kill blotches of white matter in the brain. Like
that's
it's
crazy.
Not good, right? Like all bad things. But then you have ketamine that just pokes through and it's like, yeet, just kidding, not me. Like I actually make, you know, your neurons grow faster. And they stick together more. It creates these little like spike proteins, and I cure depression. And I'm like, it's totally different. But that's the complexity of NMDA. It's like, it doesn't just do one thing, it does a million things. And depending on how you bind to it and what else is going on in the brain, it can have totally different effects.
That's really fascinating, like that difference, especially between like alcohol and these other substances. Like, I think that's like the Trip-Sitter signature, like this discussion that we're currently having interwoven between this. But like, did you like learn about other drugs? Like, was it the psychedelics that brought you, or was it just weed?
It probably was, yeah. I mean, after high school, I started going to school right away. I was studying to be a paramedic, and those guys drink a lot. So during that time, we're going out like every weekend, and it just was starting to get old. I was starting to like, you know, Monday would come and I like didn't do any of my schoolwork and stuff. And like literally the only reason why was because I was out drinking. So that was just kind of off-putting. Mm-hmm. And then right after I graduated, I went to Peru and did ayahuasca, and that really opened my mind. I mean, I did lots of mushrooms and things before that, LSD and stuff, but that like really opened my mind, came back and just pretty much just changed the whole way I was acting after that. I still would drink, but kind of more reserved. I just kind of leaned in on like weed a bit more, like if I went out to parties and stuff. So I wouldn't say that it was the ayahuasca, but it was that plus all of the other experiences I had where it was just showing me that alcohol is just not worth my time or my money. It kind of faded out, I would say. And I still drink, but like very occasional, you know, it's like special occasions or maybe after like a nice dinner, I'll get a beer or something.
You know what I mean? Do you have like an intentionality with it when you drink now that you didn't before? Like I know that psychedelics have kind of taught me to have an intentionality with every substance that I take in, especially when I drink personally. Do you find that to be like a similar experience?
I'd say so. Yeah. Like it's purely like social, and it's not even like a casual social. It's like, if I'm like, I'm here visiting my family, my friends in Calgary. So this weekend we went out and I was like, you know what? I'm going to not restrain myself too much because this is a special occasion. But when next week comes around, I'm not going to have the same kind of justification for it. You know, I might have like one or two, but you know, New Year's is coming, Christmas is coming. So those kind of are the, I guess, I don't know if I would say intentional, but they're like the exceptions to it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I'm kind of the same way where it's like every now and then I'm like, oh yeah, like I'll let loose and kind of get a little drunk, because like it's fun to get drunk every now and then as long as you do it in like a harm reduction mindset. But so when I met my partner's parents for the first time,
a great start, a real strong start.
I don't imagine that they're listening to this podcast, but it would be really funny if they do, because it gets brought up pretty much any time we come around. So basically, I was like, okay, I'm like really nervous. I got to like, you know, meet these people, but I know that they like, you know, like to have fun and they're here to like have vacation or whatever. They were visiting Nashville for Thanksgiving. And at the time, me and my partner had been dating like 2 months, like not a long enough time to be meeting your family for Thanksgiving, to be completely honest. But but we were doing it anyways. And so I was pretty nervous, but we went to this one bar, and as we were waiting in line, her dad says like, "Now that's the kind of bar I want." And I can't do a Boston accent, but he's got like a really thick Boston accent.
I love that that was your attempt at a Boston accent.
Oh no, no, it was not. That was just like, I'm doing a voice of another person. I promise I'm not trying.
Boston.
Yeah.
That's more New York, isn't it?
I have no idea, honestly, how to tell the difference.
Ouch, a knife straight to my heart.
I'm sorry. I do not have an ear for accents. I'm so bad at like discerning where people are from. I grew up my whole life in the Midwest, Michigan. That's the only thing I heard was pop and, oh, how you doing? And, you know, it's like, it's never.
Y'all.
Yeah. No, there was never y'all in Michigan. No, I did pick up y'all when I moved to Nashville. And I actually have picked up a little bit of a Southern accent, I think. Mm-hmm.
A very slight
yeah,
drawl.
Which when I moved here, I honestly thought that Southern accents were fake. Like they, it made me irritated when I heard people with like really thick Southern accents in like TV and movies and stuff. Cause I was like, oh, you're just like putting on an act. And I was like, this is over the top. And I didn't realize that it was like real. And when I was in college and I was passing this guy and I was like, hey, how's it going? He's like, hey, pretty good. How are you? And I was like, what? It just like blew me away. I was like, oh, it's real?
The original birds aren't real as accents aren't real.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, he's like, no, that's the kind of place I want to go visit. Like as we're walking into another bar. And so like, I know that he likes to be kind of like mischievous. And so I'm like, hey, like, how about we sneak away after we go in here for a bit and the two of us will go over to that bar and check it out. He's like, yeah. Let's do that. And so we're in there for a bit. And I fully told my girlfriend that we were doing this because I was like, there's no way we're actually sneaking away from this. So, and her only response to me was, do not lose my dad. That was the only thing that she said to me was, do not lose my dad. And
good advice.
Yeah. And so at this point, I've already had a few drinks. I'm like a little bit tipsy, but I'm not like drunk. And we go to this other bar and it's packed. And we go up to the second story and there's like this bar in the second story and it's also packed. He's like, oh, you like Fireball? And I was like, yeah, I guess. And so I went to go get Fireball and I guess he went to the bathroom. I didn't realize. And so I get the Fireball and I'm like looking around and I can't see him anywhere and I'm freaking out. And he later told my girlfriend, now fiance, that he saw me looking for him and was like laughing at me, like holding our Fireballs and just like looking around with panic and just like, where did he go? I can't lose him. This is the one job.
Very classic dad move though, to laugh at you while you're panicking.
Exactly. Yeah. And I drink that Fireball and that's the last thing I remember from that night. Apparently I definitely made an ass of myself, but
oh, no.
In a way that everyone thought was funny and endearing. Cause when I get overly perfect. Drunk and I'm like making an ass of myself, I'm doing it by being like, am I being annoying? I'm so sorry.
Which in itself is the most annoying part.
And it's really irritating, but everyone's like, oh, he's just worried that he's upsetting us. And so,
I think it's funny with both alcohol and weed, when you're trying to act normal is when you're acting weird.
Yeah,
you know, when
exactly.
You're like really stoned and you're walking, and you're like, I'm walking weird. So you start walking and now all of a sudden you're like doing this weird like monkey walk or something. It's pretty funny. It's like if you just didn't think about it or didn't question it, you'd be fine before that.
Yeah.
No one would know.
The first thing that I said when I woke up was, do I need to apologize to everyone? Which is what I always say if I wake up from a blackout. It had been like 5 or 6 years since I had done that, but I still remembered the right technique. I said, do I need to apologize to everyone? And she said, no, it's cool. They all know my dad made you do it.
Honestly, a brilliant move on behalf of a dad trying to like suss out his child's partner, being like, who are you really? Let's get you blackout done.
Yeah, it was a really fun Thanksgiving meal the next day. It was a good time.
Did you keep it down is the real question.
Oh, yeah. No, the next day I did not drink because I was like, they need to see that I don't need to drink every day.
It's important.
And also, I might have thrown up if I did. Anyways, that's my fun story, Rowan. Let's get back to the serious.
Well, the reason why I wanted to ask about Canadian binge drinking culture is because I grew up on Long Island, the like pinnacle of suburban middle-class white culture where binge drinking is the norm. Long Island is the home of the vodka aunt and the wine mom.
Okay. I've heard of the wine mom, but I've never heard of the vodka aunt.
Oh, the vodka aunt is the really, really messy aunt who, like, lives out in the Hamptons, who comes and visits every once in a while and just, like, fucks shit up for the entire family and then goes, I'm gonna go back to the Hamptons, and then leaves.
She's, like, also popping benzos at the same time kind of vibe.
Oh, of course. A Xanax was really the one of choice. Or maybe a Valium.
Yeah, that's the real trick to binge drinking is to, you can have less if you also take benzos.
You really have to make it last.
Yeah.
But so, like, it was very normalized. My parents weren't really big drinkers particularly, but their siblings were, and, like, the people I was around a lot, because I also went to Boy Scouts growing up, and so, like, having the, like, fathers drinking beer was a very normalized thing. But I actually smoked weed before I ever drank, because I was in Boy Scouts, and I was, like, 12 years old, and my friend had, like, had a plug, and he started, like, selling very young, and so he brought it to Boy Scouts, and we were smoking out, and I was just, like, I remember my first experience smoking was just laying in the grass and seeing the stars and then looking up and being like, everything is black and white, and him turning to me and being like, it's just nighttime.
It's dark.
That's funny.
And so, like, I had this relationship to weed beforehand. It was this very, like, scandalous thing. And it was illegal, so that was, like, the thing that you had to hide. But drinking was, like, super normal. But I preferred the feeling of being high.
Yeah. If you're drinking, you're just experimenting, right? But if you're smoking, then you're going down a troublesome path.
Quite literally. Yeah. Like, that was the very normalized thing. But so I started drinking regular then at around, like, 14, 15, because high school parties, obviously, they were drinking all the time. And theater kids, historically, I know it's a big shock that I did theater in school, but they drink, like, a lot more than I think other students do. I think it's, like, if you are in a clique that is isolated, you're encouraged to encourage each other to binge drink more. And so that was a very normalized thing, and getting blackout drunk.
Or use other substances.
And other substances, absolutely. And so, yeah, I was part of, like, the theater kids, the scene kids, where all of these, like, really self-harmful behaviors were very much encouraged.
Wait, were you a scene kid too?
Unfortunately,
oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I was a scene kid in high school.
What is that? What even is a scene kid?
It's like emo, but happy.
Yeah. The music it's not just screaming, it's also some melodies.
Yeah.
That's the difference between emo and scene, I think.
Yeah.
So, like, growing up in this, like, culture where substances was taboo, but normalized at the same time was very, very strange, because it was all about just, like, upkeep and, like, maintaining pretenses. So, like, if you were drunk, or if you were high, or if you were on Adderall, if you were on Oxy or Xanax, as long as you seemed like you weren't fucked up, no one questioned anything.
No worries, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, the moment I was caught with weed was, like, a life-ending thing. And so weed was always heavily, heavily restricted. But then I just was able to get access to alcohol, which was, like, infinitely more dangerous for me. Not just, like, developmentally, but, like, quite literally. Like, there were nights I'm like, ah, yes, I should not have been alive. Like, doing double-digit shots was not abnormal in the culture of Long Island youth.
Yeah, that's awful. that's
real bad.
So much. Yeah, that's enough to kill an adult. And, you know, if you're, like, a teenager, that's, like, wild. Yeah,
it really was.
Yeah, no tolerance and probably no dinner before you started drinking. Like, all the bad stuff you're not supposed to do.
You're definitely not drinking every day. Like, as a teenager, you're probably, like, if you're lucky, you're drinking every 3 or 4 days, like, whenever you can get your hands on it, you know? And so it's, like, not enough. Enough to really build up, like, a good tolerance, not enough to handle double digit shots. Except for, I guess, unless you're built different.
Unless you're built different, bro. What can I tell you? There was one time very specifically, this is going to be probably the most Long Island sentence I've ever said. I was visiting my friend's grandfather's summer house on Shelter Island. And it was like this, like, layered, like, top raised house, because there were poles posted up from everywhere. And we had locked ourselves out of the house after having 24 shots worth of Fireball.
That's the right amount of alcohol to lock yourself out of the house on.
Hopefully with the alcohol locked inside.
The alcohol was in fact locked inside.
Oh, so the need to get in was urgent.
Was urgent and desperate. And so my friend Marco, God, Marco, I hope you're doing okay, hoisted me up on his shoulders. So I then, like, Spider-Man climbed up the balcony of this house and genuinely broke into someone's house. Perfect. To let them all back in.
Oh, that's, I thought you were going to say that you picked up a rock and smashed a window or something. That's actually pretty impressive, honestly.
If anyone had been watching, one, the police not should have been called, but would have been called. Yeah. And two, maybe an ambulance, because, like, a gaggle of 8 blackout drunk children never a good sign.
Yeah, not what you want to see.
But so, like, because I had this limited access to weed, I started, like, seeking out from all these other places, and I started binge drinking a bunch. And also, I started, like, an oxy dependency because I was like, I gotta find a fix somewhere. Mm. I was, like, a grizzled war veteran in high school. Like, every single morning, I would have a black coffee and an edible. Like, I don't know what was happening, but I was like, I just got back from Nam, so I gotta do this somehow.
Yelling at people as they walk by.
Just like in my sunglasses. I was also a suspenders and bow tie kid in high school. So could you imagine this combination of aesthetics happening?
I need to see a high school pic. I know I've showed you mine.
I'll send you some. It'll be wild. Because I looked like an old queen. Like I'd been through the drag circuit. I just like smoking a cigarette all the time. Yeah. And so I ended up going to college where I was in a fraternity, which notoriously is really safe when it comes to alcohol.
Yeah, at least if you have a dependence on it.
They're all about moderation.
Yeah, it'll keep you going. Yeah. And so, like, drinking beer became very much the norm there. And I only got out of, like, genuine alcoholism because of weed. Because I was able to have regular access to it, and because I was able to like get that numbing agency somewhere, that was the only reason I was able to get away from alcohol. And I think that that's a really distinct cultural shift. I know, like, in other places like Europe or like other countries where like drinking younger is normalized, like you have a beer or a wine with dinner and like you don't end up becoming dependent on these substances. Yeah. It's a very interesting thing that we would rather people binge drink here once it's safe.
Yeah. Well, and there's so much around the culture of it all. You know, like I said, there's like a history of quote unquote alcoholism in my family, which, you know, we could do a whole episode on that. But but suffice to say, there's been a lot of chaotic drinking in my family, but mostly functional. I have like a couple of relatives that have gone like to rehab and gotten sober. But for the most part, it's like people, you know, like my grandpa would switch from coffee to beer at noon. But he's like retired. And so he's like, you know, after he has two beers, my grandma says he can't drive. And he's like just kind of around the house and it's not really a big deal. And, you know, like if someone else comes over, like an uncle or whatever, then they might split a 24 pack of Natty Light between them. And and it's just kind of like the way it was. My dad, in an effort to, I guess, make sure that I didn't become like that, refused to drink around me at all. I think the first time I saw him have a drink, I was probably 20. Mm. He didn't drink a lot. He used to buy a handle of vodka for New Year's, and he would have to buy that handle like every 2 years. so... Yeah, it was kind of like hidden from me. And I think that that made it something I like was more excited about, like wanted to seek out more, kind of like its own level of problem. And at the same time, my dad and my mom were daily smokers of weed and had been my whole life. And they had to hide it my whole life too. So like my mom had to like lock herself in her room, or like sometimes she would lock me outside if like friends came over, things like that. And my dad would like wait until I went to bed and then roll a joint. And I wonder all the time, like my sister, she and her husband smoke, and the way that they are able to treat it with their kids is, I think, just so interesting. A real like bright spot for the future, maybe, where like their kids know that they're down in the basement smoking weed with me and my dad. They know that that's what we're doing, why we're huddled around a corner in the backyard or whatever. They know like what it is and how it makes other people feel when they take it, and like why we do it. And, you know, like things like that. It's not something that has to be hidden. I feel like that tide is changing. And I think that the culture around weed has changed a lot too, where it's no longer like, you know, like in high school, the weed culture was gross.
I disagree.
You do? What was it like in Canada, I guess? Because I don't know what it was like for you.
Yeah, in high school, it was still illegal, but it wasn't really like frowned upon or anything. I mean, it was with my parents. Yeah. My parents hated that I smoked weed, so I had to hide it from them. But in general, like people would just leave class halfway through, walk up to the top lot. There'd always be someone up there in the parking lot, smoke a few bowls or something and go back to class. That was like extremely normal.
That's cool.
And I don't know anyone that's ever gotten in trouble from it or anything. Like it was just kind of like, yeah, really? It's illegal, but like, you know, don't be obvious about it. And it wasn't really a big deal.
I forget I forget all the time that Canada legalized so much earlier than anyone in America mm-hmm. did. And like the opinions on weed changed so much earlier in Canada than in America.
Yeah, I don't know when they started changing, but it was definitely before my time. But it didn't get legalized until I think 2018 mm-hmm. officially. Mm-hmm. And even then it was like super weird rollout. I was living in Vancouver at the time and like they had all these, just like they have for mushrooms now, they had all these pot shops. You can only buy weed there. And they were just like on the side in downtown areas, just wherever, totally illegal. Anyway, they mm-hmm. made them legal. They made weed legal, but they barely handed out any of these like coveted licenses to sell for like a right. year. There was like two places in Vancouver and like maybe one or two in Toronto. And like, that's pretty much it for like the early stages. So they just allowed these shops to continue operating for a long time. And even when the legal ones started coming out, everyone would go to the illegal ones because you go to the new legal pot shops, all the weed is forced to be stored in these like huge containers, mm-hmm. like a nug and then this huge container. By the time you open it, it's completely dry. It's extremely expensive. They had like their tax, you know, fingers into it. So you get, you know, half the value. So everyone's like, screw that. I'm just still going to keep going to my, you know, around the corner illegal shop or call the mm-hmm. guy that I've been calling for the last 10 years. Yeah. Now it's stabilized and it's very different and it's just as easy and cheap to get alcohol as. In fact, where I was living in Vancouver, there was more pot shops than liquor shops. The very occasional times you're like, we should go grab some beers or something. You're like, where even is a liquor store? You have to, like, go find one. Yeah. Walking past like three pot shops on the way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like overrun in Michigan right now. Weed is so cheap there now. You can get an ounce of weed for like $50 sometimes, like crazy cheap.
It's a good deal as long as it's not shit weed. Yeah, but I think it's becoming popular for all the same reasons that we've been talking about here. Like alcohol is great, you know, for what it is, but like as a casual substance, it's one of the worst ones, arguably. Yeah. I think a lot of people just, they want something, but they don't necessarily want to feel like shit the next day or to go out and spend hundreds of dollars just on the casual couple of drinks or something. Like who wants that? Well, not who wants that. Obviously, a lot of people want that.
So here's the question then for all of us. Why are we doing this? Why is our career centered on drugs now? Like what led us to doing that?
That's a really solid question. For me, it's definitely been like I was saying before, Justin, I am the individual who got fucked for weed. I have a lot of privilege myself of like being a like charming white person. And so I didn't have to go to jail for it.
I love how you said charming.
It's an important qualifier. But I was caught doing a drug deal my junior year of high school and got suspended like for 5 days. It was like a little slap on the wrist because I was also at the time addicted to Adderall and I was in all these clubs around my school. And so I was like the model student, but had to drink to kind of like survive that. And so like smoking was also the way I kind of got through that. And so I had to like kind of go sober for my senior year of high school. And then I found weed because weed's always somewhere to find. Then I got to college and I was allegedly selling weed and got kicked out of school. And so like weed very much ruined my life in a lot of ways, but weed didn't ruin my life. The attitude around weed did. Weed truly saved my life more times than I could count because when I was drinking like insufferably, like very chaotically, when I was doing oxy all the time, or when I was doing all these various self-harm behaviors, weed was the only thing that like made it all okay and took the edge off. And I remember this one time that like made me realize like, oh, this is a thing that's really important to the world. I was at a high school party and like older people were there because the people who owned the house were like crust punks, that kind of vibe. And this guy walks in with a cane and he's like really, really not doing good. And he's like shaken. I think he has some kind of like autonomic disorder. And he sits down, someone hands him a bong. He takes a hit of the bong. He folds up the cane and walks away just like perfectly fine.
Yeah. Maybe and I was Parkinson's like, oh, this is magic. I've seen
yeah,
similar.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Seeing it happen in real life. I was also already high. Yeah. And I was like, yes, I saw God just now, I think.
I mean, you might have.
But yeah, so like that and realizing that's kind of power and then like kind of coming back to like its radical roots as I grew up and learned and as I understood Brownie Mary and like the queer activism and how much weed was involved in like the AIDS crisis and understanding the like justice-oriented movements behind drug movements.
Wait, hold on. Wait, how is weed involved in the AIDS crisis? I'm sorry, I don't know that.
So weed was the primary method for minimizing pain during AIDS.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
And so like Brownie Mary specifically is an example of a woman. She was in San Francisco, I believe. She was this old woman, got raided by like the DEA multiple times because she had a mass brownie production that she would make. She would make all these brownies and give them to AIDS patients dying in hospital wards who like no one wanted to touch them because they didn't understand how AIDS worked. And that was the only thing that would like get people to eat.
Yeah, that's one of the best medical uses of weed, I think, is appetite. Yeah.
Yeah, with like cancer patients. Mm-hmm. And,
it's just I've had a lot of people in my life overdose from drugs because weed wasn't an option for them. Mm. Like that, I think, is the core crux of harm reduction and the thing that like makes me want to do this and be involved in this work is like, oh, removing the stigma around drugs. And like it started with weed and has now grown specifically with Trip-Sitter to all of these other drugs and like the harm reduction mindset in general. But I think that is like the biggest thing, like kind of our podcast with Miriam was talking about, like if people have access to safe things, they won't go to more dangerous things. And I think for a lot of young people, alcohol is the first option because there is nothing else.
Yeah.
And so that core of it feels like why I'm doing this, of like making it so that way people understand what is actually safe.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that. Justin, you want to go next?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I came to it mostly from my interest in psychedelics, in consciousness, philosophy, all of these things kind of overlap. So, I mean, I've been growing mushrooms since I was like 16 and weed, you know, I've always been interested in that stuff. I studied paramedics because I didn't have high enough grades to study medicine, but I was interested in that field. After that, I did my actual degree is in herbal medicine. So I'm just super interested in like the pharmacology of traditional plants, psychoactive or not. The psychoactive ones just are a little bit more fun to talk about.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And yeah, with Trip-Sitter, the whole goal is like education. As many of our previous podcast episodes have shown, like, don't think anything should be illegal. I don't think any substance should be illegal. But I think people do need to know what they're getting into and how to get out of it if they get stuck in it. And it's hard to do those things, but it's not that complicated, all of this stuff. So I think it's just like Trip-Sitter is just a good way to really break everything down into individual parts. There's some really fascinating stuff. There's some dangerous stuff. You just have to know all of it and you'll be good.
Yeah. It's like we say in every episode, right? It's how we approach these drugs and our relationship with them that determines whether their use is good or bad.
Totally. I think it was Vincent that said the definition of drugism is like, you know, even in your own mind, you feel like you put drugs in different classes. Like even talking about this, I'm like, oh, I don't drink alcohol, sucks. But like, that's just my own personal view of it, right? And like, there are people that disagree and there are things that I like salvia. I'm actually a really big fan of salvia. Most people hate that one and that's fair enough. Yeah. And they think that salvia just makes you go completely off. It makes you crazy and it has no medical use, definitely, like all this stuff. And I think probably it's somewhere in the middle. Both are true, you know, all drugs, treating all drugs evenly.
But I think you can do it. Like, I think there you absolutely, like we've been saying this whole time, like it is moderation. Like you can use it intentionally. You can go into a situation being like, I'm going to have a couple drinks to unwind, or I'm going to use it as a social lubricant, or I'm going to take off the edge. Like being a comedian, when I was doing stand-up comedy, the normalization of just like having to get a drink at the bar every single time. Mm-hmm. And you wonder why comedians are like some of the most fucked up people in the world.
Yeah.
What about you, James? Yeah. Why are you doing this?
So I have, a pretty unconventional story from a lot of people that I've kind of met. I came to this world sort of by accident, is probably the wrong word, but like feeling my way out, I guess. Mm. I was not like raised Christian. I became a Christian when I was in high school and pretty much immediately became like a very staunch Christian, very much so looking for like a place of belonging and finding it in a youth group. But then when, so I had all this like drug stuff in my youth between like my parents hiding their weed use. My mom like moved away and left me with my dad when I was 13. And so we had like a pretty messed up relationship after that. And I always kind of associated it with this thing that she's doing in secret. Her weed use is like making her just try to have like the most relaxed, do nothing life she can have, because all she wants to do is smoke weed and all this other stuff. And then when I was, I guess it was a little bit before that, when my sister first got arrested for shoplifting and we discovered that it was to fund a heroin habit. And that started this whole long line of rehab and relapse and problems with alcohol and cannabis and, you know, whatever drug you can have a problem with. It really showcases that the problem isn't really the drug, it's something else. Anyways, all that to say, I had a pretty stigmatized view that I felt was rooted in hard life evidence. As a lot of people do who have family members that struggle with chaotic drug use, they frequently think that the drug is the problem and that is the reason for concern. And I tried smoking weed when I was in like seventh or eighth grade, like right when I moved in with my dad, and I was like problematic youth face before I found Jesus. I like tried to like smoke one of my dad's roaches before school one day. I was trying to light it on like the toaster. I couldn't find a lighter. So it did not work out. And then I drank a couple of times and then I became a Christian, and I very stigmatized view towards drugs and drug use in general. And then when I was 18, my mom mom passed away unexpectedly from what I've recently discovered was a fentanyl overdose.
Oh, shit.
A medically prescribed fentanyl patch. She had like osteoporosis and a lot of pain problems her whole life. And I also have recently realized that she also had probably a dependence and chaotic use with opioids and was likely overprescribed them because it was around that time when that was quite easy, around 2010. So
that's a wild full circle moment.
It really is. Yeah. And this is something I literally realized like 4 months ago. And so when I say that I came into this world accidentally, like in a lot of ways, I feel like it's kind of like in my DNA. Mm. My mom was a writer. She published 3 romance novels that never made a dollar, but she was a writer and that was like her dream. And she always wanted to do that. And so I had like an internship at a church for a while. And I was like, I don't really know if this is like for me, and started working in like hotels. And I started doing hotel sales. I got really into it for like 5 years. I moved up like a part-time front desk agent to a director of sales of this hotel in San Antonio. And then me and my ex split. And I was like, I am not starting my life over in Texas. And so
good call. Great call.
Immediately started applying around to other places. I had some friends still here in Nashville from where I went to college, got a job in tech sales. And I did that for a while. And then as COVID hit, I was in this new job and it was very clear that I wasn't going to last my 90-day probationary period, which thankfully was actually 95 days, so that I could actually get that unemployment that was boosted at the time. So it was like this weird scenario where I knew I was going to get fired and I was really terrified about it, but it was also an opportunity to make around the same amount of money without a job and figure something else out. I'd never been happy in my life in any job I'd worked. I'd always been miserable. And so I was trying to like see the optimistic side of it or whatever. And I took all of that into a mushroom trip on the Saturday before the Monday that I was going to get fired, which is not an optimal time to take mushrooms for most people.
If you're 13, don't make sure you don't do mushrooms the day before you get fired.
Notably, I was 28. So, and I spent the whole time realizing that, I mean, you know, we talked about it in a recent episode that you have like these profound realizations sometimes on psychedelics that aren't profound at all, but they're like the first time you believe them and they become profound to you. And so like I came out of that with 2 things that I immediately told my girlfriend, now fiance, which was 1, I think I'm a special person and I think you are too. And I think we all are. And 2, I deserve happiness and so do you. And those were the 2 things that I had never believed before. Mm. And so because of that, I felt like this turn has to go towards drugs. Like I felt like I had to like go back towards that. Even 4 years ago when I was starting this journey, psychedelics were not thought of the way they are now. I feel like the culture has shifted so much on them, where even now in like Christian circles, like I'm starting to get like some friend requests back on Facebook.
Look out for our cult series, everyone.
People are starting to realize like it's been this demonized thing for no reason. And even all drugs are starting to come around to that. And so like when I started this, I was very much like Bambi in the woods. So like I started by mostly pitching around like CBD shops. And I was like, I just want to write about cannabis, read as much as I can about it, like taught myself how to read research papers and stuff as best as I can. Anyone out there who catches some shit I mess up, please tell me, but the best I can. And I did that all through like cannabis and CBD and trying to work with these different clients and do like retail. And then Tripsitter was my first publication I ever landed like a article series on, which was after my trip to Portugal, where I got to see what decriminalization looks like and how it affects society and how it could be better with legalization, but it's still pretty great. And so that was my first time really thinking about like other drugs in the same way that I thought about psychedelics and weed. I was never like a psychedelic exceptionalist. Like I never thought like only these drugs should be legal, but I was definitely only a proponent for psychedelics. And I think it was like my trip in Portugal where I was like, I think all drugs need to be my focus. And I need to like figure out how to talk about like the nuances of all of this. And so I think that just kind of has like solidified my kind of current path.
They're right. Weed is a gateway drug.
It is, yeah. But it's like, how many people smoke weed after drinking coffee first? Because coffee could be a gateway drug.
I don't know if I consider coffee. I know it's psychoactive, but like, it's not actually, I don't think I agree with that argument.
Here's my thing is that I drink too much coffee now. And like, I have periods where I am able to like get my drinking coffee down and like get my tolerance down. And when I do that, I definitely feel like it's a drug. When I use it in moderation, if you're only having one cup of coffee a day, you feel that cup of coffee so hard. Mm.
Speaking of coffee and alcohol together, when I worked at Starbucks for a while when I was in high school, a thing that we would do because we worked in a mall, specifically during like holiday season, because working in a mall and a Starbucks during holiday season, nightmare, terrible. Anyone who works at a coffee shop currently, I'm so sorry.
Shout out to my fiance.
Shout out to your fiance. I'm so sorry. If you mix a chai frappuccino at Starbucks with Fireball whiskey, okay, it tastes like nothing. It is delicious.
Like nothing?
It's so good.
Oh, like nothing else.
It tastes like nothing. Okay. It doesn't taste like you've added anything.
Gotcha. Okay.
No, I mean, you could like beer bong it, I guess, if you really want to, but you might really get a brain freeze.
No, I thought you were saying it like it cancels out all flavors from both and it has no flavor at all.
I was drinking a lot of them, so perhaps. Yeah. Who's to say?
Yeah, actually, that's a hot tip, is if you drink three of any alcohol, then all alcohol tastes great.
As we're landing, I want to give my little alcohol fun fact, because I have a little fun fact about the origins of alcohol. Okay. I had to read this book in high school called The Five Drinks That Made the World or something along lines.
Beer and wine are definitely two of them.
Huge ones. Yeah, and then coffee, it was like probably coffee and water and Coca-Cola, I think.
Coca-Cola made it in there.
Yeah, that actually sadly makes sense, but yeah.
Yeah, I think it was coffee and tea and Coca-Cola. I think the tea was the correct one there. But the reason why beer exists at all is because a bunch of hunter-gatherers, the lore, I suppose, goes, is that there was a barrel of wheat that was rained in and forgotten for a while. And then soggy, the fermented wheat. And then people drank it because they were like, I suppose, and then they really liked it.
Yeah, it's also been a backbone of the church on occasion. Monasteries brewed beer for finances for a long time, especially back when it was like the only kind of drink you could get.
Because it was cleaner than water.
Yeah, because it was the only water you drank that didn't possibly have cholera in it or something. Mm-hmm.
But I want all of my water to have cholera.
Yeah, no, I think it's really cool. We say this kind of behind the scenes on a lot of episodes, but the three of us really bring three very different backgrounds to a lot of the conversations that we have. It's really interesting getting to kind of break it down a little bit more, because we have completely different relationships with all of these drugs, because like we're just completely different people. And it's encouraging to kind of like hear other people's stories of how they got to where they're at. And I hope that it is also interesting to others.
You've made it this far in the podcast, I would assume.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We'll assume you're not 13 as well, please.
Please, for the love of God, don't be 13. And if you are, just don't let anyone, don't let us know. We just don't want to hear about
it. Don't want it. Okay, so you want to close out? Maybe we can each try to think of like the most compelling moment that you're willing to share from an experience on any drug. And I can go first. When I was kind of starting off using mushrooms, so like that time that I used them was around the first time that I like found myself with any. Like my plug had just gotten some and I had had them like a few times, and I'd worked my way up to my first 5 gram dose, which also has been my only 5 gram dose. And I decided I was gonna like McKenna Styles it and set myself up in my closet, like all the lights turned off, nice padded area for me to like lay down and sit on. And I took the mushrooms and I sat down and I almost immediately was like, nope, this isn't gonna work. Got up and I like was like laying in bed. I like turned on the TV. I was like totally just like running from it, because it just was bringing up all of these like past like shameful moments. Mm. And I don't want to get like too specific on it, but these past shameful moments just kind of like flashing before me. And so I was kind of like just trying to ride it out and like watch TV through it or whatever, and like remind myself like, you know, you took a drug, like this is gonna end. And all this other stuff. And like around the come down, I had this moment where it's like, I don't know if you both have experienced this, but it's like this moment of, I call them like fully formed memories of events that never happened, that like kind of happen in psychedelics, where like a lot of people think like, oh, I traveled to the future, or like I visited an alternate reality. And you might have, but I think that it's just a really interesting like thing that happens and phenomenon that happens to me sometimes. And I had this one where I got to like travel to the future and see the person from like all these events that were coming up in my life, and have this moment of closure where we like got to have a conversation together, and they even like asked me about my fiance, who was just my girlfriend at the time. And so I took it as like this like really cool sign that, like, you know, in my innermost self, I felt like in the future, like she was going to be a part of it, even if I was like meeting up with this person from my past. And I thought that was a really profound moment that changed a lot of things in my life, where I felt like, you know, A, for about a week, I thought it was really going to happen, which, you know, it still might, but yeah, but for about a week, I thought it would really happen. And then, but I was still like, the whole time I was just like, wow, like how cool that I got to experience that and have that moment and like let go of all of that. If only in like some weird made up realm within my drugged experience or whatever, and get to like feel that and feel how much of that has been weighing me down up until now, because until you get rid of it, you don't really realize. And so that was, you know, I had a lot of like work to do after that to like actually get to the point where I felt like that weight had been lifted. But that was like a hugely profound moment for me that still sticks out as one of the top five experiences in my life, probably.
That makes a lot of sense. Justin, do you have a compelling experience to share?
But I can dig deep. There was a time, actually, I was at Shambhala. So there was a lot of psychedelics going on. I had this moment on, I probably only took like 3 grams of mushrooms, but then, you know, probably had acid in the morning and smoking weed all throughout the day. So it felt like way more. So I had to like leave the crowd a little bit and just kind of go spend some time on myself and like chill out a little bit. I had this really like, I don't even know what you would call it, like a glimpse of like nirvana or something, like a moment of, I realized that, you know, I've been meditating for a long time, even before that, and I've always been very interested in like Eastern philosophy, and I had this like life-changing realization that all of the blocks that I had in front of my vision or my experience was inside my own head, and I could choose to just stop trying. And I would do that, and I would my consciousness would like go to like a whole other area, and then I would come back, and I'd feel like, oh wow, I just like traveled somewhere, let me see if I can do that again. And it wasn't for probably another 10 years after that I realized that there's a lot of explanations for that. That's basically the fundamentals of like Zen Buddhism or a lot of like Taoism, is this idea of like even the trying to like reach nirvana or become more enlightened or like stop letting your ego kind of control your life, just by trying to do that, you're actually creating more of that. So there's this like paradox of like, in order to stop that, you have to stop trying. And mushroom showed me that, and that definitely changed philosophically how I interact with the world from that point on.
Yeah, I felt that as you were saying it, like I felt my body being like
That's a really cool story. What about you, Ro?
Yeah. The first time I ever did acid was me and 12 of my closest friends in this co-ed fraternity. We dropped at around like 1 p.m. We went outside. We were all in this place called the Witch's Grave on the college campus that we were on, which already is a weird like vibe for a place.
Great place to take acid.
It was a place in which the fraternity that I was in like 50 or 60 years prior, they had pledged people in an abandoned Augustinian church that burned down. And so we were all doing these acid. We had like weird religious moments pop up. Like we found a 24 karat gold cross buried in the ground where we were doing acid.
That's wild.
The people were making like biblical allusions. It was all like, it felt very narrative moment. Like, yes, we are projecting the narrative onto this group of people, this like 13 people, auspicious number. We go back inside. One person who like everyone collectively unspoken had decided was Judas, they went off into their own corner and watched chicken beheadings in a separate room, because that's what Judas would do, I assume.
Wait, watched chicken beheading, like videos or
like YouTube videos? Okay, yeah.
You know, on YouTube
of things, normal normal things.
If there was LSD and YouTube in Jesus' time, Judas would have definitely been doing that.
Right? It sounds very Judas. So we have this whole experience. I have this deeply profound realization that everything is narrative, that like everyone kind of clings on, like a very Jungian understanding of like everything clings onto these archetypes. Everyone sees their shadow through these archetypes, understands themselves and relates to each other better through all these stories.
I get that.
And it was like this deeply profound moment of understanding.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And then after we all come back to the next day, we learn that Notre Dame burned down.
Oh shit, that was the same time?
This was recent then. That was only like 2 years ago, wasn't it?
2019, yeah. Oh, 2019. That's 4 years ago now.
That's wild to have like all that religious symbolism in your
synchronicity
trip and then have Notre Dame burned down.
And doing it at the place where a church that the fraternity had hazed people in also burned down. Like there was a lot going on and we were all like, well, I guess we're done here. And then the fraternity disbanded.
No way.
Like, not as a direct correlation, but there were a lot of series of events that led directly from that trip that disbanded the organization, which was like, I was like, ah, yes, we're breaking generational curses here.
That's wild. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, I think that's probably a good place to stop. I'm really excited about the new year. I just want to say that too. Because like, since this is coming out around that time, so much has happened this year. And we've really like built this and our like Substack community up so much. And I'm just like really pumped about the new year's. And so just wanted to end by saying like cheers and thanks to you. And thanks to whoever decides to listen all the way through this.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
And that's another episode of the Trip Sitter Podcast. Thanks for sticking around and being such a special part of our 2023. We hope you have a great 2024. Trip Sitter is supported by our fans. If you dig the work we do and want to help support us to keep doing it, head over to tripsitter.substack.com and become a premium subscriber to help support us. Want to show your support but can't do the monetary commitment? Review, like, and share this podcast. It really does help boost our listenership. This episode was co-hosted by Jay Gordon Curtis, Justin Cook, and Rowan Zioli. Jay Gordon Curtis is also the producer of this podcast and the co-editor, along with Ronilo Villamore. As always, we want to end with a reminder. There's no such thing as a bad drug. They're just chemicals, natural or unnatural, that exist within our world. It's our relationship with them and how we interact with them that makes the difference. Until next year, have a safe trip.